Well, for those of you who weren't on the weekend, you missed a really fun event. It was, I thought, for me at any rate, both super interesting and also, not to be over sentimental about it, but really heartwarming. I just really felt it helped reinforce why I do this stuff. And this is kind of a real utopian event in its own right, I felt, with respect to the kind of world we all try to create in the micro settings where we create it. So it was great. I appreciated all the enthusiasm that was on display. Well, it's been a long 10th semester. This is the last session. In retrospect, I think it's actually a nice thing to have done it this way. I think I'll do it this way in the future. That is, cancel the Tuesday before Thanksgiving as creating a kind of breather in the semester, and then adding this last Thursday. In the past, when the semester ends on that weekend, which of course is a nice celebratory moment to do so, I also felt I would have liked to have kind of regathered with the students that constituted this class and then have a chance to kind of take stock of the whole semester, think about the big themes, have a more freewheeling discussion. So we did this out of improvisation, but I think I'll make this the standard way of organizing the schedule of the class. So I thought what I would do is genuinely give some short thoughts of my own, thinking about the semester as a whole and how these pieces fit together and the dilemmas that we're left with. To strictly stop on the button by 10:30, if not before, even if I'm in the middle of a sentence. And then it's not so much that then you should ask questions just about what I say. Just, you can be thinking, maybe you've already been doing so, just issues you want to raise about the, from any part of the course, or from these last few weeks that we've been talking about theory of history and alternatives. So let me just sort of step back from the specifics and give some thoughts on the whole thing. So just to go back to the very beginning of the course, what we've been doing this semester is one particular way of exploring, I hope with some rigor and in a systematic way, what it means to do an emancipatory social science, what it means to build a theoretical framework and a set of ideas that are both empirical, that is, they are about the world and how it actually is and how it works, and theoretical and philosophical even. They're concerned with big moral and normative issues about the world that we would like to see. And to do that, we grounded it in a set of values that I laid out at the beginning, and then talked initially about these four tasks: the normative task, diagnosis and critique, thinking of alternatives, and a theory of transformation. And then in a way put that in the background and just systematically went through the core ideas of the Marxist tradition. Class, state, and ideology, the subtitle of the course. What the class, state, and ideology part really gives us is an account of the sources of harm in the world in which we live and the obstacles that we face in trying to do something about them. So most of the course is actually centered around the diagnosis and critique part of the problem, and then those elements of a theory of transformation that speak to the difficulty of transformation. That is, it's basically the focus on the question of the state and ideology are really on the way in which the state and ideology contain these problems rather than enable their solution. Right. Now, mostly that's what social theory does. That's its home ground. That's where research and theory feels it's on the surest footing, showing where the harms come from and showing why it's hard to do anything about them. That's why critical theory is often discouraging. It struck me in the course, when I think back about this course as a whole, that that's really what mostly we talk about. And that it's only kind of at the tail end that the question of thinking about alternatives and the actual problem of transformation gets foregrounded. That probably roughly reflects the distribution of work in the literature, so to speak. You know, so it's not a misrepresentation of the scholarship. That's, I think, what people are, where the work is. But it is an unfortunate aspect of the scholarship because ultimately the diagnosis of where the harms come from and the exploration of the obstacles to doing anything about it, that is the way ideology and the state reproduce the basic structures, all of that is meant to just be stage setting, fundamentally. Now, that's really just the prologue. The real business of a critical emancipatory theory is figuring out how to change the world. You know, Marx's 11th thesis says that, you know, 150 years or so ago, philosophers have only interpreted the world. The point is to change it. And then in the end, when you get down to really thinking about what do we know about how to change it, well, a lot of it's speculation. A lot of it is just anecdotes about how its struggles have taken place in the past, rather than as compelling and bedrock account that's at the equivalent level of solidity as our account of the critique and the obstacles. Well, that's just the way things are. You know, that's the state of our knowledge. Like, you can't, by an act of will, just leap over that. And I think if I made the course 20% on obstacles and the diagnosis and critique and tried to spend 80% of our time talking about transformation and the logics of change, I think it actually wouldn't be as good a course in the end, because it wouldn't equip you with the kind of language and ideas and concepts that are the bread and butter of what people do. But it is, therefore, this is sort of my first point about the course as a whole. It's a imbalance that I think all of you who want to continue thinking about these things should be attentive to. The next 30 years of scholarship, in which I hope to participate for at least part of that 30 years. I don't have any predictions about my ultimate demise in the academic world, but this is definitely a meandering soliloquy here. We made a job offer to a young sociologist, gave a job talk last week. He's already got an offer from us, Chris Mueller, who I am desperate to hire, really desperate. I mean, I haven't seen somebody who I think would be as close a collaborator and in the Haven Center and in this part of the department. No, he would be really by far the closest I've had in all the time I've been here. And when he came in for my one-to-one interview, I said, well, do you have any questions? And he said, you know, I really want to talk to you about basic income. And we had a fantastically sophisticated and interesting discussion about basic income as a proposal. And he's very much in favor of it and how the various issues around it. It was clearly he was at a level of discussion of those issues, even though this has nothing whatsoever to do with his dissertation research. That was just really superb. He's very left-wing, very engaged in the kind of things we've been talking about. So I sent him an email trying to get him to come, and I said, okay, so I'm just going to be straightforward. I want to address some of the things that might be of concern to you, and one of them is what's my time horizon, because I think one of the attractions for him to come here would be that he could work with me on things. And I said that I plan to die in the saddle. And I don't know how long in the future that will be, but I'm pretty confident there's at least 2 decades ahead, and with any luck, could extend beyond that. So that's sort of my time horizon. So I'm definitely, my commitments now are to work on the alternatives and transformations problem rather than why we can't do anything and why the world is so miserable problem. But I encourage all of you to, in whatever you do, to put some of your intellectual energy around that part of the equation. All right, so transformation and obstacles. In the tradition, in the Marxian tradition, the pivot of the obstacle to transformation is the state. Ideology is important, but ideology actually functions primarily as a way of interfering with the challenge to the state. The prize is seizing state power. Ideology, false consciousness, all the things around subjectivity and culture, which are important themes, mainly figure in the analysis as explaining why, when the masses of people would benefit from transforming the system, and the way to transform the system is to seize state power, why they can't get their act together to seize state power. Why can you not get your act together to seize state power? Because there's so many divisions within the working class, there's so many antagonisms, and there's so much confusion in people's visions about the causes of their plights and the solutions. So ideology, the way I think the pieces fit together in the traditional framework, is that the class structure and the economic institutions generate the harms. That's the real source of, the root source of harm. The state protects it through coercion, blocks transformation, allocates resources to shore up the system, to solve its problems. And ideology and its associated forms, this would include things like ethnic conflict, which in the traditional view would be primarily viewed as the way in which identities interfere with solidarity within classes. All of these help explain why collective action is incapable of seizing state power. But the pivot, the point of transformation that matters historically, and therefore why the rhetoric and the imagery of revolution plays such a big role, is the seizure of this concentrated, centralized sources of power, transforming it as an instrument, because the form that is seized is not suitable for fundamental transformation, so the state itself has to be transformed, and that then unleashes a capacity to transform the society. That's the traditional classical view. That view had then interfaced with the theory of history by giving people reason to believe that it was possible. Right? So without the particular elements of the theory of history, the idea that eventually you'd be able to seize state power and transform the state itself in a way that would enable you to use it to transform social institutions and economic structures, that might seem pretty far-fetched to people, that you could actually do it. The way in which the theory of history plays a role then, in either its grand version or the special version for capitalism, is it explains why the capacity of the state to reproduce the social institutions becomes weaker and weaker over time, and the sources of division within the mass of people who would gain from seizing state power, those divisions become weaker and weaker over time. That is, workers become more homogeneous, they become a bigger proportion of the population, they become more concentrated, their capacity for struggle in general increases. The economic institutions become more and more deeply crisis-ridden and therefore more vulnerable. And the state institutions then face ever tougher tasks in reproducing an ever more decrepit system, facing an ever more capable opponent. Well, that's a nice recipe if all of those trends operate in those ways for giving credibility to the claim that state power is seizable in the way needed to transform the society at large. Well, that's a brief recapitulation of what we thought about, what we discussed in the last few weeks. Some people still think that there's basic credibility, the details may be off, but there's ways of reconstructing it. Instead of it being the falling rate of profit, there's some thought that perhaps the environmental crisis functions in a similar way. Capitalism destroys its ecological conditions of existence, even if it doesn't destroy its material economic conditions of existence. and that that creates the same kind of crisis tendencies of an increasingly intense form that make the system more vulnerable and fragile to transformation. It's possible that there is a way to reconstruct that traditional, very optimistic view about how history is going to do a lot of the work. Kind of the laws of motion of the system are going to do a lot of the work needed to set the stage for transformation. I don't find any of those reconstructions credible. That is, I think it's hand-waving. It's wishful thinking. That there's just as much reason to believe that the environmental crisis creates massive new opportunities for capital accumulation. True, it won't be of the neoliberal form. It won't be what we've seen. It'll be different. But capitalism has gone through all sorts of metamorphoses to find new ways of accumulating, maintaining the fundamental power relations over the allocation of resources and the organization of economic relations. I think an ecologically reconstructive capitalism will be a state-led, have a much stronger state-led component. The state will play a much bigger role. And that's because the collective public goods aspect of climate mitigation and adaptation requires a strong state that's going to orchestrate the projects, but the projects will still be carried out by capitalist firms, and they will still be a basis for private appropriation and private profit. So just as building the interstate highway system in the United States was enormously profitable for capitalism, both because the new transportation systems were profitable, but also because the building of the infrastructure was done by private firms. And just as military spending is enormously profitable, military is the classic public good. I mean, we may think of it as a public bad for moral reasons, but it's a public good in the sense that it's provided through the state appropriation of surplus to pay for a capacity to defend us all. So it's a public good. Whether you like it or not, it's a public good. Funded through taxes, orchestrated by the state, but enormously profitable for capitalism. That's why it's called the military-industrial complex. Well, we'll have an ecological industrial complex, which has to be state-led, just like military spending is state-led. Nobody, you know, even the most neoconservative, neoliberal numbskull, nobody says that military spending should be left up to the market. You know, I mean, nobody would argue that we should just let market forces decide how much we should spend on the military. Of course not. They all say, yes, this is a public good. We have to do it. And they channel 8% of GDP into the profit-making capacity of Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and other giant military contractors. Well, we'll have ecological contractors. They'll probably be the same as the military contractors, I suspect. You know, they'll take over. And it'll be enormously profitable. So my point there is there's just no reason, I think, to believe that any of these endogenous crisis mechanisms are going to be of the sort that necessarily means the system becomes fragile and becomes unreproducible by virtue of the crisis mechanisms per se. And that means that we can't count on that as being part of the setting of the conditions under which we can once again think of the classic scenario, seizing state power, using that concentrated capacity of transformation that states allow, transforming the mechanisms of the state so it becomes a proper instrument for democratic rule rather than for capitalist rule, and then transforming the society through that instrumentality. That means I just don't think a ruptural strategy executed from the center is plausible. Now, that doesn't mean, and sometimes I think on future writings I have to stress this more clearly, it doesn't mean that some of the things that have been associated with ruptural strategies aren't relevant for our understanding of transformation. And in particular, ruptural strategies have this imagery of warfare, right, of a confrontation with the enemy in which there's winners and losers, there's decisive battles. I mean, all of this kind of militaristic metaphor gets deployed in ruptural and revolutionary strategies. So sometimes when I talk about interstitial and symbiotic strategies, people interpret it as also implying feel-good, win-win, sort of smiley face politics where you're constantly seeking compromise and consensus on good faith terms with opposing interests, rather than seeing politics as involving struggles and real confrontations in which there are victories and defeats, and that there are moments when those victories and defeats are crucial for allowing symbiotic transformations to proceed in ways that open up more space for interstitial transformation. So I need to, that's one of the kind of clarifications and reworkings that I'm, in my next iteration of this, that I'll be emphasizing, is taking this ruptural, symbiotic, and interstitial logics of transformation, maintaining that, but kind of disaggregating them into different dimensions and showing how the confrontational tactics may be important for symbiotic strategies. It's just that confrontational tactics are not part of a ruptural vision, that there is some kind of a major confrontation at some point that enables system break to occur. All right, so then the issue is whether there's any more plausibility to this vision of transformation than there is to the ruptural vision. The ruptural vision, even if it's not very plausible that we could have a rupture, it does have a certain prima facie plausibility to it as something which, if you could snap your fingers, it could accomplish what you want. You know, I use this snap your fingers test. I've talked about that a little bit. It's if you want a social change, if you envision a social change as being good, desirable, are you prepared to just snap your fingers and have it happen? Or would you hesitate because you haven't thought through enough the possible ramifications and maybe it could be worse than could create a worse situation? So some things I'd happily snap my fingers for. Other things I'd be hesitant but still might do it. I'd take the gamble. And other things, even though I believe they'd be a good thing, I probably wouldn't. You know, I would say there needs to be a process by which you get there, and the snap your finger process would be an undesirable process. So ruptural transformations do have this kind of face plausibility to them because the world seems so oppressive, the powers that be are so strong. If only you could see state power, then you could smash them, clear away the rubble, and get on with the business of reconstructing the world. Well, as I've said, I think unintended consequences of trying to do that unleashes a set of forces where you don't end up where you want to end up. So I think it's not very likely that even if you could have a rupture, it would produce the outcome you'd want. Therefore, I think the only scenarios are thinking about this interplay of symbiotic and interstitial transformation. And then the question is, what are the things we can do that make that as plausible as possible? My focus has been mostly on thinking through the kinds of interstitial transformations which are themselves constitutive of the alternative I would like, and particularly focusing on those that you can actually build pieces of in the world today. I've given less attention to the complementary symbiotic transformations, that's more what I'm working on now, that open up the space for interstitial transformations, because it's really the combination of the two that defines a political program, not just the interstitial. So if you just take the interstitial transformations as being your entire program, that's pretty much in keeping with certain strands of what might be called positive anarchism. The word anarchism has lots of baggage, like every word does. Sometimes anarchism is used as a self-identification of merely destructive combating against the system without any constructive building of alternatives. So what I would call positive anarchism is this interstitial building of alternatives. Troy Gardens, Just Coffee, you know, the things in Madison that are exemplars. Okay, we just hit exactly 10:30, that's enough prologue, enough of me talking. You've heard most of this in one form or another. Anyway, so the floor is open. Anything goes. Yeah.
So what do you think the timeline would be for this type of transformation? Do you think that it's really, like there will be small things like just coffee and other like little bits of things like that, and that ultimately in a long time we'll see some like real significant changes, or will that come sooner?
I wish I had some handle on the problem, on the time. So here's my standard answer to that, which is not very satisfactory, but it's still it's a standard answer, and that is how surprising even the near future can be. Just how perplexingly surprising it can be. So there's a little exercise I do, and I, at the end of Envisioning Real Utopias, if you read the very end of it, I go through this little exercise. If you start in 1900 and go in, or 1905 is I think when I start, it's, the arithmetic works out better. You start in 1905 and go in 15-year increments and ask, put yourself at the beginning of that 15 years and ask how many people would have predicted the world that was 15 years later and how completely surprising it is. So start in 1905. By 1920, you have the Russian Revolution, the most horrendous war in human history, the First World War, in that 15-year period. The Mexican Revolution. So some of these things, you know, in 1905, would the Mexican Revolution have been predicted by people who were really on the ground there, who saw the contradictions amassing? You know, some of these things may be more surprising to outsiders than insiders. I think the Russian Revolution was surprising to everybody, including the Bolsheviks. I mean, you know, they really did not think they'd be able to seize power in the way they did. Go from 1920 to 1935, the Great Depression, the collapse of the stock market, the rise of Hitler. From 1935 to 1950, you know, World War II, the atomic bomb, et cetera, et cetera. From 1950 to 1965, the end of Jim Crow, the collapse of the racial state that had been in place so solidly. From 1965, in the height of the civil rights movement, the emerging student movement in 1980, Ronald Reagan gets elected, the complete collapse of social movements, the emergence of neoliberalism, from 1980 to 1995, the end of communism, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the transition to brutal capitalism throughout the Eastern Europe. You know, so in each, the point is, there's so much indeterminacy and unexpected possibility that I think that's part of the answer to the question of what's the time horizon. You know, it's an now. I think another kind of question is, what are the steps that you would want to see happen in these unexpected windows of opportunity? I don't think the world will be transformed simply by the slow incremental energies of people to create more just coffees and more Troy Gardens and more participatory budget experiments, although I think all those things are important. There does need to be political initiatives to create new institutions at the political level that will allow these things to flourish and to expand. And when the opportunities for that occur, it's both unpredictable, but also you have, that's the sort of thing in which you need to have programmatic ideas in place so that when you can institute them, you're in a position to do so. And that's I think, where left intellectual work could really make a difference. You know, we need the left equivalent of ALEC. You know, ALEC is this legislative think tank to provide model legislation for right-wing politicians when they get in power to legislate things that will destroy all the possibilities we want. But we need the equivalent of a left-wing ALEC. Joel Rogers and Cowes are involved in some of that. They call it ALICE instead of ALEC. I don't know what the acronym, it's some concocted acronym to be a counterpoint to ALEC. I think that's absolutely pivotal kind of work. And the way I would describe that work is it's trying to think through the symbiotic politics and policies that make possible more far-reaching interstitial transformations. Yeah.
Okay, so a lot throughout this class, I feel like we've been talking about, like, even if we'll go to, like, local examples, we talk about a lot of things on, like, a national level, I feel. So, like, I've been struggling a lot with, like, where the role of, like, community versus the role of the state, like, comes in, and, like, who would get forgotten if the state ends up taking on a lot of these responsibilities, and, like, also, like, a communist ideal was achieved, like, what would happen to, like, the concept of, like, nation states? Would they, like, do you know what I mean? Like, would they still play a role? Would people kind of, like, be more focused on local community or, like, do you know what I mean? I'm just trying to figure out the role of community.
Right, right.
And stuff like that.
Yeah, so, by the way, this doesn't need to be just Q&A to me.
I mean,
so these are, you know, so anybody jump in, raise your hand, add to the question, give your own thoughts. Community is something which I think is an absolutely foundational value, but like a lot of values, it has a dark side to it. There's communities which are the most emotionally rich, solidaristic bonds that people have with each other in a way in which they feel real solidarity in the sense of desire for the well-being of everyone within that community. It often brings with it exclusion. You know, there's a boundary to who you care about. And so communitarian and or community values, which I do think are crucial, it's crucial to human flourishing, to be embedded in community, also has the risk of strengthening modes of exclusion. Now, my own idea about that is that that exclusionary aspect of community typically comes from the way community also intersects inequalities of various sorts. It's because there are other stakes in play, like access to resources or jobs or investments, whatever. There's other things connected to community that then ups the ante about who's in and who's out. And if those stakes are low, then the exclusionary character of communities will be much weaker. Not necessarily zero, but much weaker, and therefore more easy to deal with. And so that's the kind of, with respect to that particular issue, that's the sort of idea of a more communistic or egalitarian, social egalitarian world, is not that it makes other divisions disappear, but it makes them less salient because they have weaker ramifications for other aspects of people's lives. Now that doesn't answer the nation, state, community, what's the division between these. Some people respond to this cluster of problems by imagining world government as the answer. So the nation, state is a powerfully important source of division in the world today. It defines boundaries of personal mobility. You know, citizenship is a way of carving up the planet into zones that you can freely move to and zones you can't. And that is fundamentally a barrier to human flourishing. There's no question that the arbitrary fact of being born on one side of a border versus another, affecting where you can move, is an impediment to freedom and, in many cases, to human flourishing. So the nations and nation states are often seen as these very negative institutional barriers. And one way of thinking about transcending it is to have global government, world government, and then dissolve the national boundaries, rendering them perhaps like state boundaries in the U.S. So you do need jurisdictions of political coordination below the global level. There's all sorts of problems, collective action problems, public goods that have to be provided by some kind of coordinating entity. And it can't, the idea that this could be done from some centralized global institution is just monstrous. It's completely implausible. the historically salient nations could thus become like U.S. states in a federated structure. The historical states would then become like big counties. You know, you just rejigger the hierarchy of institutions. Whether that's the vision for a distant global polity, or whether it's some other way of thinking about it, where there is a more radical dissolution of nation states. So in Europe, one could imagine a more radical dissolution of historic nation states, so that the entities below the level of Europe would be regions. And there is this discussion in Europe of a Europe of regions rather than a Europe of sub-states, where regions are defined for different purposes depending upon what the issue is. So there's some regions that are ecological, there are some regions that are cultural, there are some regions that would be scientific, you know, academic or something like that, because of different ways of wanting to organize education systems. There could be just different, there'd be these overlapping, intersecting regions of governance, but they wouldn't be states. You see little whiffs of that even in the U.S. So some metropolitan areas have a metropolitan transit authority, right, which is a public institution. It's not a state. It's a public institution that governs the transportation system for the region, that cross-cuts all sorts of political boundaries. Well, one could imagine a world where you have that instead of states. I don't have any well worked out, you know, views on how that. Yeah.
Something connected to that, like in the other direction, and that instead of looking, you know, how would nation states deal with global communities? Like I'm thinking more of what are the limitations of change from the nation state as opposed to an international political economy that is increasingly. So like persons are limited by being born in X or Y territory, but capital increasingly isn't, and is, you know, Americans, Europeans, whatever, are owners of lands and mines and whatever everywhere. And so it's just unclear to me, like, if to emphasize the energy and interstitial symbiotic or even rupture logics that exist in some places on national politics. And if things can be achieved in an emancipatory way without addressing international political economy rules. So, I don't know what the question is, but I don't know where to put the energy, you know, because it seems like increasingly international rules matter a lot.
Right.
And place huge limitations on what can be achieved on a national level.
Right.
So.
They do matter a lot. How much they impose limits on what can be achieved is a matter of debate. So there's often an exaggeration of the constraints on local initiatives created by global institutions. Sometimes not. Sometimes they really are fantastic constraints. But sometimes there are powerful interests that have a interest in making it seem like the constraints are bigger than they are. Right, so one should always, I think, have some skepticism. When politicians say we can't do anything because of rules about global finance, is that really true? So what often the full sentence is, we can't do anything given global finance, and given that we don't want to redistribute income from the wealthy in our country, we don't want to increase effective taxes on them, and impose capital controls, which we could control, we could do. But we don't want to do that because the rich and powerful in our country don't want it. That means that the constraint is really the use of international constraints by local national elites as a way of blocking challenges that would be adverse to their interests, rather than that the constraints per se are imposing the global constraints per se are blocking a more redistributive national strategy. So I think the first thing is one should always be a bit skeptical of the strong forms of these constraints, because believing in those constraints unquestionably serves the interests of national elites. It immunizes them from challenge. We can't do anything about this. You know, in Mexico, one of the richest people in the world is in Mexico, right? I forget the guy's name. Yeah, so he's got a huge interest in saying, you can't increase taxes on me because of global constraints, right? So there are global constraints. There's lots of room for maneuver and for creating new institutions and for enabling bottom-up initiatives.
But how do you address, like, it seems like the nature of the present empire is so dispersed and there's no, like, one center of power that can be identified? That, for example, like, right now, and I'm thinking this because Mexico is basically going to sell its oil to transnational companies, and it's, like, one of the basics of the state. That obviously is going to change what the state can do, where the power lies, who can decide the agenda. And so it just seems to me that in a lot of places, the nature of national elites is changing, and that the power is moving
right
elsewhere, and that that will affect national politics and how much can be done within a particular territory. But I guess it varies in each context. But
right. So in each context, there is the question of what are the vehicles for challenging these claims of the disempowerment of the state. So what are the vehicles? What are the political parties? What are the social organizations, the social movements that can effectively challenge these policy prescriptions that are being executed at the center? That's one set of questions. And another set of questions, which is iconically represented more, let's say, by the Zapatista strategy, is what sorts of things can we do in spite of that to insulate ourselves from interference from these regressive national politics and to construct enclaves. So their strategy is not just interstitial, just building new institutions in the spaces. It's to create barriers to the penetration of these disruptive forces, you know, with some modest success. I mean, it's obviously fraught with its own limitations, but so there is this vision of a kind of thinking Zapatista-like strategies for local activists and local political forces to create the possibility of sustainable local empowerment for building alternatives, which is creating more space than for interstitial work. And in many ways, that, in principle, should be easier in places like North America, because the resource base for doing it would be so much greater. But of course, the political and ideological conditions for doing it may be much weaker. Yeah?
So, I don't know, I've been thinking about this we touched on it in office hours once, about how, as an individual, do you live a life that, you know, that goes along with these ideals that we're talking about, that, like, that tries to, as an individual, you try to support, you know, egalitarian principles, and as, you know, as you, like, make decisions about, like, what you want to do with your life, you know, how do you direct those towards these goals? You know, like, what's the best way to help see the realization of these sort of utopian things that we want?
So, that question can be then broken down into two sorts of choices that everybody makes. One about how you use your time, and the other is how do you use your resources. So everybody makes those choices. So the simplest answer to your question is there's a whole range of consumption choices we make. So this is stuff that everybody, you have to do anyway. You have to make consumption choices. in which you can make consumption choices that reinforce rather than undermine the interstitial alternatives to capitalism. You can buy just coffee rather, I mean, just a simple local example. You can buy just coffee rather than Starbucks, to take the polar example, or, you know, other coffee brands. You can buy just coffee, knowing that in doing so, you are helping to support a local coffee firm that is organized on real utopian, democratic, egalitarian principles, but also is committed to a global strategy of support for cooperatives in Central America and whatever. So there's now a big enough array of such consumption possibilities that's a non-trivial way in which, just in your own private life and making decisions, which you have to make anyway. Now that in some cases doesn't involve any cost, it just involves paying attention. So just coffee is, I don't think, particularly more expensive than its rivals because it cuts out all these middlemen. So it saves on the supply chain and then pays more to the co-ops and ends up costing about the same. Maybe it's a little bit more, I don't know exactly. What? Than other premium coffees? Okay, so $1, it's $1 more, whatever. So you can make that's part of the decision-making stuff you have. And there's a range of, you can pay attention to that. There's some, that's an example of something which doesn't make much difference in the world in terms of your own individual contribution because you're not spending a lot of money. But in the aggregate, it could make quite a big difference. So one issue then is expanding the number of people who are engaged in these alternative circuits of economic activity. This is all interstitial work. In terms of then the time side, that's how you spend your money. On the time side, then it's a question of how in your own life you can organize work that you do, the way you spend your time, that bears on building these kinds of alternatives. That means when there are political campaigns that go on in which there's the possibility of changing the rules of the game, you become very active in political work. So in the Recall Walker campaign, lots of people who had never canvassed door-to-door did a huge amount of canvassing door-to-door. It didn't work out, it wasn't successful, so part of it is just deciding to engage in politics. There are career choices one can make in which your life is more directly bound up within the world of alternatives rather than the world of mainstream organizations. And that may involve what an outsider might think of as big trade-offs, but the insider's view is it's more fulfilling and satisfying in ways that it's not experienced as a big trade-off. But I don't have more magical suggestions. If you do this, you will change the world.
It's been hard for me a little bit to get past the Shaworsky's analysis, which is just so damning of where our possibilities are in terms of reconfiguring the state. That even were a socialist or working class party to occupy state powers, the very logic of the way that they can accrue and maintain power once they get in there is going to corrode the principles that differentiate them from mainstream or dominant powers. And I see the idea of interstitial transformations seems hopeful, but in this kind of positive anarchist way, but it still doesn't resolve the problem that Shaworsky identifies of how we can actually have a state system that can support these transformations. And I don't know if others have had more fruitful ways to think of this than just being depressed.
So Shaworsky's is very much a top-down perspective. So he is asking the question, can you move from capitalism to socialism through a set of clever policies at the center that push us along this transition once you get elected into office? And the key part of the dilemma is you do have to maintain the stability of a capitalist economy while you are trying to transform it. Because if you don't, things can get so bad that people will abandon the path. That's the kind of key aspect of the agenda. Now that assumes that the only way to, from the center, to engage in practices which expand the zones of life in which people are acting in non-capitalist ways has to also be destabilizing, sharply destabilizing to capitalism. And I think that's because the vision of transformation was top-down, centralist, classic socialism. You know, you threaten to expropriate the capitalist firms, you announce we're on a path where we're going to expropriate everybody, it's going to take us 10 years, capitalists immediately start disinvesting, the economy falls apart. Well, if you have as your strategy, we've seized power, we're going to create new credit institutions to make it easier for cooperatives to function, to get credit and to produce for local economies. We're going to reform the healthcare system in ways that contains costs, because we now have the power to do so, which are going to reduce the burdens on capitalist firms to be able to cover the healthcare benefits of their employees, etc. Well, they might fight that because they don't like the idea of the government taking it over, but it doesn't destabilize capitalism if you succeed in instituting those programs. So it becomes just the political battle. Can you have a stable enough coalition to actually win the battle? But it's symbiotic in the sense of actually making capitalism work better. It's just that it's working better in a more restricted space. Right, so cooperatives don't threaten capitalism except to the extent that in the long term people will opt for them. But not in the sense that well-functioning cooperatives that are producing for a market, that are involving lots of worker energy and activity, that those cooperatives themselves generate crisis in capitalism. You know, so I think part of the Shvorsky pessimism comes from it being too much of a direct confrontation with capital, rather than thinking through the ways in which you can expand these non-capitalist spaces.
Yeah, I totally get that. I'm thinking about my experience with this and the Wisconsin recall, and seeing that people will sort of, I think, bestow too much wishful thinking on the power of recall to actually shift the dynamics when Scott Walker could outspend everybody else by billions of dollars.
Right. So just to make a comment on that.
Yeah.
I think it's historically contingent, not determined, that that election was lost. I think Barrett's a crappy candidate. He lost the first election for good reason. I mean, not for good reason. He would have been a better governor than Scott Walker. But he's not an attractive candidate for all sorts of reasons. Just imagine if a dynamic, straightforward, really energetic candidate had been running, and imagine if the strategy had been different, if there hadn't been this 5-month period when Walker had unfettered ability to attack the very idea of the recall. So the strategy that was in place for that period was, in November when the petition drive started, the electorate was 55% in favor of the recall and 45% opposed. But the recall petition drive and then the selection of a candidate and the primary for all of that took 5 months, during which time Walker relentlessly attacked the very idea of the recall as a violation of democratic principles. So that by the time of the election, 17% of the people who voted for Walker said they planned to vote for Obama in the upcoming presidential election. So they weren't supporting Walker's positions, they just felt the recall wasn't legitimate. Well, those are historically contingent reasons why that big mobilization failed to accomplish that goal. If it had accomplished the goal, it wasn't going to create socialism. You know, this was a very defensive move. It wasn't, there was no positive vision of a building an alternative, but it would have created more space. If you want to respond to this, and then I think you had your hand. Yeah,
just as a response, I spent this past summer interning at the Capitol in the office of the state representative, and what frustrated me so much was that, like, in politics, and, like, you know, when you're elected or, like, when you have to deal with just, like, political stuff, you can't be... It's hard to be open to alternatives, and it's really hard to be open-minded, and that's what made me so frustrated with the people in my office. And, you know, people would talk about stuff, and, like, they would have their ideas, they would have their rhetoric, and they wouldn't think about it in, like, an academic or, like, thoughtful way. And so I think a lot of it is that, like, politics is organized in a way that sort of dampens thought and, like, makes it really hard to, like, to think about things in, like, an ambitious way, because people will just, like, shoot you down and not take you seriously. And so I think that also, like, is a big part of the problem. A big part of the problem with the recall is that people weren't organized, and because there was no space for, like, really, like, constructive thinking, it didn't allow people to become organized.
So let me just comment on that. And then, it's very easy to have that impression. That's the argument that it's consciousness and ideology which is the fundamental obstacle, that people are so sucked into the dominant ways of thinking about things that they won't even listen, so that there's this real closure. I think that that ideologies are more fragile than that. I don't think people are as deep. Most people are true believers of the existing set of alternatives and the existing way of doing things, that they feel deeply in their bones committed to it. It's much more a question of intellectual habits than it is of depth of real commitment. And so surprising things can happen then. The person just elected to be governor, to be mayor of Minneapolis, Betsy Hodges, took this class in 1995 or so. She was a extremely radical socialist graduate student in the class analysis program, total activist. Left ABD because she was an activist and wanted to be involved in community stuff in Minneapolis, where she came from. Became a city councilor and was just elected mayor of Minneapolis, and hasn't changed her views one bit. You know, I'm sure her rhetoric may have changed, but not the underlying values that the rhetoric conveyed. You know, I just think Minneapolis is, you know, it's a liberal, freewheeling place. It has lots of, it's not unlike Madison in many ways in terms of the amount of interstitial innovation that's taking place all over the city in all kinds of ways. And that creates the foundations for different kinds of politics. But it took 20 years still for her, or 15, not quite 20 years for her, to go from being a community activist to a city councilwoman to a mayor. Now, that's just, you know, a special example of an individual person, but I think it also reflects there being more open possibilities than one might imagine at any given time. Yeah?
So doesn't, I mean, obviously, this is the case, like, everything that are related to, I mean, doesn't this, like, sort of interstitial stuff make more possible the, I mean, even structural change, or, like, you know, taking state power? I mean, if the economy was 35% cooperative and the people working in those were actually politicized in some sense about that, you know, that's easy to imagine. I mean, that's kind of what was in Spain before it lost or whatever. But, I mean, like, if we imagine something like that, that would make this sort of top-down change that Krzyzewski, that he is worried about much more possible, you know, the shock wouldn't be as big and like...
Sure.
So, I mean, can't... Yeah, I don't know.
I think that's right. So I think even if you believe that ultimately there'd be some point at which some decisive break with the existing power structure will be needed, or that, or another way to put it, is in the absence of that, you hit absolute limits. Right? So there'll be, you'll reach a point of a completely stagnant set of interstitial possibilities, no further expansion. So at that point, either the situation could be, well, the world's a lot better than it was because there's all these ways that people can opt out of a capitalist way of life into a more egalitarian, communitarian, social way of life. And this is a sort of stable modus vivendi where 35% of the economy is, and of economic activity is organized in humane, socially just ways, and 65% is still crappy, right? Or whatever, you know, whatever the equilibrium is. So at that point, one could imagine you've reached a barrier, you can't change it, but it's stable. It could be at that point you've reached a barrier, but it's not stable, and that the risk is there'll be a reversal. And at that point, then maybe a ruptural possibility emerges out of crisis conditions. And one might say, well, we're in much better position now to successfully have a rupture than we would have been in the absence of this long period of building this alternative. That's kind of like the capitalism to feudalism to capitalism story, that the toppling of the feudal state institutions that were barriers to capitalist development, that rupture only worked to liberate capitalism because capitalism was already there in substantial measure. So that would be the kind of an analog to the to that proposal. So I mean that's a way to think about it if one still feels in one's guts that a rupture is needed. That doesn't necessarily mean that a rupture could still succeed even under those conditions. We don't have a good enough theory to be able to make any kind of reasoned prediction that even under the most favorable situation, a rupture could succeed in generating the kind of society we want. Yeah?
This is kind of in response to your answer to Maddie, and it's about ideology. So my I guess, interpretation of what we call failure was, and part is the media, and the power of the Koch brothers, and the power, and the economic power of people to control the means of communication, which then influenced ideology, and then influenced the voters. And so in, I've been reading, ideology of power and the power of ideology. And Terraform seems to construct two arguments that are kind of going in the opposite direction past each other in my mind. I'm sure it doesn't, but in my mind I can't figure it out. So one of them is that ideology is kind of an open territory, and people's subjectivity can be formed by these matrices of factors that form ideology, that influence ideology. But that ultimately they're materially determined. So material matrices, material forces are more important than discursive forces. And yet, he kind of leaves open the possibility for successful struggle. But it seems that if, you know, the elites will always control the economic, the material, because they will always, more and more they control concentrated wealth, then they will always control ideology. So, like the Wisconsin recall seems to be an example where you had a democratic state with a lot of really engaged people, and yet, you know, outside of Madison, people in their own homes are watching the news, and this is where their ideologies are being shaped, and it is materially determined. So, how do you get beyond that?
Well, the Terraborn's notion of materially determined is not watching the news; it's the affirmations and sanctions in your life as you live your life in its ordinary ways that reinforces or undermines particular beliefs about what is good, what is possible, and what exists. So if that's his material matrix of affirmations and sanctions, not the bombardment of sheer message from watching something. Now, if from Terborn's perspective, or from my jiggering of Terborn's perspective, the way to challenge the dominant ideology that there is no alternative to capitalism, which is the thing we're talking about. So he's not really talking about what kind of propaganda enables you to win an election where both sides of the election are pro-capitalist. Right, so which is... Right, right, but, right, so there was a difference. So, but to, on the more general point of what interstitial transformations do is create in the world different material affirmations and sanctions. And then people encounter those. So lots of people have never heard of a worker cooperative, or they may have heard of it, but they have not a clue what it is. If worker cooperatives expand, if you make it easier for them to happen, then when people try them, the affirmations and sanctions support the idea of worker cooperatives. When you lack the credit institutions, when there aren't networks among cooperatives, when each cooperative enterprise is undercapitalized and faces stiff competition from capitalist firms, then the affirmations and sanctions continually reinforce the idea that you need private initiative and entrepreneurship in order to have successful market firms. So creating the environment in which cooperatives thrive, what that means is creating the environment in which the affirmations and sanctions of the beliefs about capitalism versus cooperatives can change. That's the sort of long-term way in which ideologies then would be anchored in different affirmations and sanctions. Now, in terms of things like the recall election, I think the affirmations and sanctions that set the stage around this issue had to do with a very long-term process by which unions cease to be experienced by most people as an important part of the way in which their basic rights and ability to function in the world was enhanced. And the unions bear some responsibility for that. That is, for example, teachers' unions have only relatively recently come to realize that they have to be champions of the best high-quality child-centered educational practices, as opposed to they have to be champions of protecting the jobs at any cost of their members. So they, it's of course an exaggeration to say that unions are mostly concerned with protecting the jobs of bad teachers, but it's an exaggeration that has a kernel of truth in it. And that's part of the practices, the actual material practices of what they saw their job to be as a collective organization defending the job rights of their members. Because they took that stance, that's part of what gave the right wing a point of entry, then in the propagandistic mode of just hammering away that unions are these obstructions to good quality education for your kids. Now, I think teachers' unions are not so much like that anymore. I think they do have a broader vision now. They came to realize this. It would have been great if they had realized that when they were powerful and where they really did have a monopoly over the job conditions. If they then said, look, it's our responsibility to discipline bad teachers and to really solve this problem. It's not a big problem. It's a small problem compared to other problems, but it is a problem, and it's a problem which we can do something about. Well, that would have, if teachers had seen themselves as a social movement around education, if teachers' unions, as kind of social movement unionism rather than pure business union, you know, not business unionism, but, you know, job-based unionism for their members, if they had had that more progressive and expansive view, could have meant that they were in a different position when they came under attack. It also might have meant they'd be less likely to get under attack, as the right wing may have felt that they didn't have the leverage to do it. So, I mean, that's a, the sort of thing that I would, that's the way I would use Terborn to think about some of these sorts of issues. Yeah?
Do you think it's a problem at all that you put so much focus on material affirmations and sanctions when so much of decision making involves the future, where people haven't experienced affirmations and sanctions about future decisions? I mean, they're making decisions based on, I guess, their past affirmations and sanctions.
Well, remember, the affirmations and sanctions are reinforcing or undermining beliefs, because the object of the study of ideology are beliefs that people hold about the world. What is good, what is possible, what exists. That's a pretty complex view of beliefs. It's not, you know, it's a full bore, fully rounded view of beliefs. The affirmations and sanctions idea is to say the beliefs people hold should not be thought of as in any simple way of they have just been told these things and they believe them. So it's against the view that starting as a baby you're told X, Y, and Z, and every year it's repeated, and it's just the messages that leads you to stably hold those beliefs when you're an adult. It's the fact that you get these messages, and the messages are themselves then reinforced or undermined by the way the world is actually working. That's the material sanctions and affirmations. When the messages correspond to those, you've got a nice stable system. When the messages don't correspond to them, that is when it's the case that the affirmations and sanctions have shifted and the messages haven't, then there's tension. And that's the point of entry where ideologies can be disrupted by counter messages. So that's why he thinks it's intergenerational. It's more likely to be intergenerational where you get these disruptions, because the messages do matter. It's because you've been taught these beliefs that you have them, but they're stable because of the affirmations and sanctions. But if the affirmations and sanctions are different from the parents' generation, well, they keep telling you the same messages because that's what they believe. But they don't sit right. They don't, you're not as comfortable with them. And then when you go to, you know, this is a common experience in the U.S. That's why the right wing hates universities. You know, Wisconsin kids come to UW as freshmen with all sorts of stereotyped conventional beliefs. But those beliefs aren't so secure because the world isn't really like that. And then they take courses and they begin talking to other people and reflecting on their own beliefs, and things get very uncomfortable. And the what is good, what is possible, and what exists becomes more malleable.
One more question.
Yeah.
Are you wearing a Highlander t-shirt?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What is that? We were just talking about Highlander at the retreat.
We had a whole session.
I was there a few weeks ago.
Oh, Stanis, show us your t-shirt. I rocked at the Highlander Center. Oh, that's good.
I suppose. I didn't make the t-shirt, though. So.
Was it good? Was it fun?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I think Grace Lee Boggs was there.
Uh-huh.
And it was like... it was one of their anniversary days.
She's pretty old, right? Like 90 or something?
Oh, yeah. It was hard to understand her. But still, like, everyone... It was fun. I don't know how to explain it.
Does everybody know what the Highlander Center is here? I mean, everybody who's at the weekend knows.
But I had a question.
Yeah.
Related to the interstitial like transformations and things like that, it seems like a lot of that has to do with positive class compromise and has to do with building alternatives that don't necessarily conflict with capitalist interests in the same way. Where do you think you stand on unions then, for instance? Because unions seem like something that are meant to be sort of a working class formation that is often in conflict with the capitalist class. But right. Then at the same time, you don't want to say like, okay, I shouldn't support unions because it represents a negative class compromise. And so do you think that building union membership is like something that we can use towards transforming system to an alternative one, or?
So So I'm totally pro-union, and I think a negative class compromise is better than no class compromise. I do think the interests of workers and capitalists are antagonistic, not just complementary, and that sometimes the best you can do is to have a collective organization capable of imposing harms on capital sufficiently that they'll make concessions. And that's what a negative class compromise is. And if that's the best you can do, it's the best you can do. You know, that's, I think I've mentioned this, that's what Big Bird from Sesame Street would say to his little charges. He would say, the best you can do is the best you can do. So don't be discouraged if it's the best you can do. Well, sometimes negative class compromise may be the best you can do. But the problem with negative class compromise is that it's always vulnerable. It just, you know, it's better than nothing, but it's easily, counter-offensives can easily undermine it. Because it depends upon the continual capacity, since there's nothing in it for the elites that you're engaged in struggle with. It depends on your continual capacity to reaffirm your ability to impose harms on them unless they stick with the concession. Now, that's why if you can find a positive class compromise, if you can find ways in which, yes, okay, we've had the strike, we've had the struggle, you've made these concessions, now we're going to help you solve problems. We're going to give you some positive, there'll be some positive benefit. We'll increase the problem-solving capacity within production, within the sector, within whatever. Because we're collectively organized, then we can use our collective brain power as a union to help solve problems. And to the extent that unions can fill that positive stabilizing role, then it makes them less vulnerable, because then there's a cost also for attacking them and undermining them. Now, positive class compromises are never permanently stable as well, because there's always this antagonism as well. You know, that's why it's complicated. It is always the case, I think, even in the places in the world which have had the most stable class positive compromises, like Germany, still the case if capitalists could snap their fingers and get rid of unions and have, you know, a free capacity to do whatever they wanted to, a lot of them would do it. They would say, yes, we know we're giving up this kind of collaborative problem-solving capacity within production, and that'll create some problems. But overall, unions are still a pain in the ass, and we'd rather not have to deal with them. So it's just that to the extent that you can forge these positive arrangements, it makes things more stable. And more generally, I think that's part of the whole symbiotic kind of issue. There's a contrast here, and I've had a debate with someone who I respect enormously, Francis Fox Piven, who is a fantastic scholar and a very important sociologist in terms of her contribution to understanding public policy and social conflict. Her very famous book, Poor People's Movements, makes the argument that it's only when poor people really disrupt things, when they cause trouble, that anything gets done to help them. So, and she means causes trouble, meaning really causes trouble, you know, like riots and disruption, real disruption. So she is very skeptical of my stuff about positive class compromise and about symbiotic transformation. She feels you just have to constantly have mobilizations that attempt to impose pain on the powers that be, whatever scope of that is relevant for the problem at hand. And my response is, it's true that that is historically the context in which, particularly in the American context, where poor people's movements get attention is when they cause trouble. But the victories are often ephemeral. You know, you win a victory, you get something done, and then as soon as your capacity to cause trouble goes down, it's reversed. And that the reason for also trying to think about symbiotic transformations is it's a way of ratcheting the system, of trying to lock in new institutional arrangements which have some staying power. And if to have staying power, they have to produce some positive effects with respect to how well the system as a whole functions. And that's their contradiction, you know. That's the whole problem, you know. The reforms that stick stabilize the system. Well, we want to transform the system. Stabilizing it seems against our objectives. But reforms that don't stabilize the system are easily reversed, so life doesn't improve. That's the kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't quality of the world in which we live. I think that dilemma is inescapable, those trade-offs, those contradictions. And you just have to figure out how best to navigate them rather than to imagine that there's some strategy which avoids them altogether. There just isn't. My feeling is there is no strategic vision we can have that avoids the dilemma. That for the victories to have durable, positive effects on oppressed groups, on disadvantaged groups, on those marginalized from them, those who are most harmed by the operation of capitalism, for the victories to have durable effects, they cannot be continually disruptive. You have to figure out a way to have the victories also have a modus vivendi with the existing system. But if they have a modus vivendi with the existing system, then they're not as radical and as progressive as one would hope for. And you know, and that's the context, just to repeat myself, where I'm struggling with this idea of interfacing interstitial and symbiotic transformations as a way of thinking through the question how to actually build an alternative that simultaneously really does embody alternative values, really does constitute alternative ways of living, and nevertheless is functionally compatible with capitalism and ideally actually makes it work better. I mean, I say ideally because that makes the interstitial spaces more robust. Yeah?
So I think all of us, maybe except you, have lived all of our lives in the neoliberal era where everything that the state does seems to continue to undermine, like make worse any possibility of like human well-being or justice or anything. And that's really tiring. I think all of us, like, it seems like overwhelming that everything that is done from a state level is bad, privatizing everything.
So first of all, just the word "everything" is a little too strong.
Yeah,
but it's important. No, it's important. I don't mean to be picky here.
Yeah. No, but you're right.
It's important to just not be too everything about everything. You know.
Okay, a good portion of it. It seems like any possibility for transformation needs to stop this neoliberal trend.
Right.
And so I guess my question is, like, why do you think it has been so, that it's lasted so long? Or maybe historically speaking, it isn't that long, but at least to me it seems pretty long, 30, 40 years, and that's still continuing. And so, like, why is that? And then what would it take to reverse that trend, even for a softer capitalism? And
right.
The crisis that just happened didn't do it, it seems like it's
right.
Not going to do it.
So I think there's the following illusion, which is that neoliberalism has only been the last 30 years. Capitalism has been neoliberal from the start, and we had an interlude, a brief interlude, which wasn't so neoliberal. I mean, it wasn't called neoliberal, it was just called liberal before. And, right, so if you go back to the 19th century, the state did almost nothing. There was no social welfare, there were no public libraries, there was practically no public education. You know, the U.S. was pretty advanced in having relatively early a commitment that education would be provided by tax money through a state institution. So even public education is a relatively recent innovation in the course of the 19th century. But the state did very little besides defense and some basic public goods infrastructure. At various stages in different countries, but basically until the 20th century, and not really in earnest, in a big way, until after World War II. You know, so, you know, the 30s and 40s, a lot of these building blocks in the U.S. were put into place, but, so there's really a kind of, let's say, between 1930-ish and the early 70s, So it's a kind of 30 to 40 year period in the history of American capitalism where we had an affirmative state that said, yes, the state has a responsibility to solve public problems, social problems, through the positive construction of opportunities and facilities of various sorts. And then it's reverted back to standard capitalism, which is that markets solve all of our problems. I think that I think there's lots of indicators that certainly in many places the neoliberal illusion has eroded. People no longer believe that, and then the question is how long a delay will it be till it gets translated into public policy in societies where political forces are capable of translating changes in public opinion into public policy. I myself think that the environmental crisis is going to kill neoliberalism, not capitalism. It'll just kill neoliberalism. You cannot have an ideology that says market solutions are the way to solve these problems and the state shouldn't be involved and deal with climate adaptation. You know, seawalls are not going to be built by the free play of the market. So the rich countries are all going to have to do these adaptation measures. This is quite apart from transitioning to a green economy. That's a whole other matter. You know, changing energy systems, they're all going to involve very big expansions of the state role. And that's going to involve very substantial increases in taxation, but not anti-capitalism. But it does create a different ideological space where social justice issues and equity issues and public goods for the people issues can become part of the, back on the agenda of the discussion, more centrally, once public goods for the survival of the planet becomes part of the policy. Yeah.
Actually, that was going to be my question. I was thinking, like, okay, maybe the state might compromise and, like, make room for the ecological crisis, but then at the same time it might continue the privatization of education and everything else, and then it's still, in most sense, a neoliberal state.
So it might. It just, it might. It could go that way. But once the idea that, yes, a healthy economy needs high taxes, not low taxes, because we have to fund these public goods, I don't see how that language isn't going to become part of the politics, and therefore the political forces that support the privatization of everything are going to have a tougher time talking about the privatization of public goods in general. So you're right. It's possible that getting rid of public education under the mantra of choice, I mean, this could continue apace even in the face of an expansion of the state's role in the economy because of climate change. But I suspect that also will create openings for more progressive politics around state provision in general.
I'm just wondering if you could just clarify what's the difference between the state acting as a neoliberal regime versus a state not shedding its neoliberal characteristics but still acting on behalf of the capital?
Well, that's, well, you know, the New Deal state was acting on behalf of capital.
Okay.
It wanted to stabilize capitalism to create better conditions for accumulation, but it did so by building up all sorts of public amenities directly through the use of state resources. The social democratic state was very concerned about having profitable businesses, of creating a good business climate, but it did so not by saying that the way to do this is for the state to have hands off, it was for the state to create all sorts of infrastructure. And so that's the sense. So the key things that make about neoliberalism, I think, that render it a distinctive form of capitalism is the rejection of state-provided public goods that private alternatives to public goods should be the way things should go, and the essential view that market allocations of resources are superior to public allocations of resources on all issues, rather than drawing lines of distinction between the kinds of problems for which public allocations of resources are preferable to private allocations. Now, the capitalist version of a public goods affirmative state is the state decides the public allocation of resources, but the actual provision of those resources are still provided by capitalist firms. You know, so the national highway system after World War II, the interstate highway system, was the contractors were, you know, laying this asphalt were all private capitalist firms. But where the roads should go, how they should be paid for, how the engineering designs, they didn't leave it up to the private capitalist firms to come up with the engineering designs. They had the, you know, public works departments and state civil engineers and whatever were actually designing the roads. Yeah?
I was just wondering, do you think there's any affinities between interstitial strategies and developing countries versus symbiotic for developing countries? Because developed countries are already well off. They have, you know, our challenges are democratizing and equalizing, whereas developing countries also have to accelerate the rate of growth. And I'm wondering if that puts more, if that makes, you know, state coordination of economic development more important. And so kind of building alternatives might, I don't know, yeah.
So I think in developing countries, let me make two quite different comments on this. I think there's a different mix of public goods that the state needs to provide under conditions of economic underdevelopment compared to a rich country. So exactly, remember, my general model is not that everything gets provided through interstitial activities. It's also the state has to provide public goods, and then interstitial activities are articulated to that in some way. So yes, yeah, so the state, the role of the specific role of the state is would be different. But I want to make another point about the whole idea of economic development. The idea that the well-being of people in developing countries must be subordinated to the imperatives of economic development is not, I think, needs to be continually challenged. And we do have these examples. They're relatively isolated, but they're significant. The most famous is Kerala, southern India. So Kerala is a case of a state in southern India which has well below average per capita income, but it has basically nearly European levels of life expectancy, infant mortality, and every indicator of well-being. And it's quite egalitarian compared to the rest of India. Now, there's very specific kinds of institutions and social structures and arrangements in Kerala that differentiated from the rest of India. Above all, it's had a strong communist party and a very strong labor movement, but not strong enough to dominate the state. So West Bengal also had a strong communist party, but it was too strong. It has been in power for 40 years, unchallenged, and it's become like any other state monopolist power, filled with corruption, rent-seeking, unaccountable to the electorate. The Communist Party of Kerala, roughly speaking, wins every other election. And it's constantly forced to compete for popular mandate. And it's pushed its opposition into a much more progressive set of policies as well. And among other things, Kerala has had the most significant land reform and the strongest pro-union movements of any place in India, and a huge drive towards female literacy. So it has, has European literacy levels for women, not quite European literacy levels for women as well as men. And all of this has meant that people's well-being is very high in Kerala compared to the rest of India, even though it doesn't attract foreign investment and doesn't have high rates of growth. Now, it's not been completely stagnant either. It's not like it's a, you know, just peaceful rural tranquility, but impoverished. It's had some development, just not at the rate of the rest of India. So, I mean, that's sort of one general point about that. I don't, and Amartya Sen emphasizes this point a lot, that it's an absolute mistake to imagine that you have to put onto the back burner egalitarian policies for human flourishing or capabilities in his language until you get development. No, what you should do is put the egalitarian project of human development on the front burner and then get as much development of a more general sense as you can, given that you're taking care of that. And you'll get enough development that way to slowly improve the material conditions that are the background conditions for other aspects of, you know, human flourishing. Now, the Kerala story is more complicated than I just told you. I gave you the kind of rosy version. You know, there are other aspects of the story which make it a little bit more problematic than I said. But I think the basic lesson is valid. Yeah.
I'm not stretching, sorry.
But you can still ask a question even if you're stretching.
I don't have a question.
Don't have a question? Okay. We didn't take a break, so we can, I think at this point we shouldn't take a break. We can just continue for another, you know, till 10 till and just stop a little early then. Other questions around these, on anything connected with the class? Yeah.
You can go, Mons.
Well, just kind of go back to kind of maybe your point was not about Mexico, but I'm maybe thinking NAFTA. Mexico's kind of suffered a lot more neoliberal fallout than other places. Compared with Bolivia, where, so you were saying that everywhere is privatized, except, you know, I think, John already knew more about Brazil. Like Bolivia and Brazil, I've definitely seen public takeover of private resources and indigenous presidents and working class presidents. And so there have been a couple of success stories. But Bolivia is, of course, a very special case where it's very homogenous. And I mean, I was actually there when they were protesting, and that could not maybe have happened anywhere else, because in Bolivia there are like four roads. And if you block those four rows, then you can kind of get a power monopoly. And so many people were mobilized. I mean, there were just like marches, such a big portion of the actual population. So, I mean, so there are like, you know, glimmers of hope, which are interesting just to note their characteristics. And Lula, I mean, I don't know how many times Lula ran before he was elected president. Four times or something. Was sort of,
the PT started in the 70s.
And there was a huge grassroots movement. But so I guess, but I mean, Mexico's story is really devastating with NAFTA. And I was wondering if there's any kind of multilateral trade agreements that aren't bad. It sounds like a really silly, naive question, but it just seems like categorically multilateral trade agreements are bad.
Well, they're forged by the wrong people.
But there is, I mean, I don't know any details of like whether on the ground it actually works really well, but in reaction to NAFTA and the proposal for the free trade, do you remember when they were trying to do like the whole America's free trade agreement? And that Brazil, Bolivia, and Venezuela were like, no, this is ridiculous, we're not going to do like the whole continent free trade zone. And so, led by Chavez, they created ADBA. Have you heard of that? And then, so it's another trade bloc, and it's basically the countries allied with Venezuela, so it's Ecuador, Bolivia. I think is Brazil part of that one? I don't know, but there's like some of the South American countries trying to do another logic of international trade, and they have even like a regional coin, which is the sucre. So like they're trying to supposedly put values of economic justice and blah blah on the forefront. On the grounds where they're actually doing that, I have no idea. But it's the
the idea that there is another way to create an international, or a, yeah, a multinational trade bloc under a different logic. I don't know if you know if there's been any success.
It's my impression that it hasn't made much difference. Yeah, no. The trade negotiations have all been done under this view that the less fettered, the less constraints are placed on the free flow of goods and capital, the more there will be mutual gains. And it's, you know, it's a bad theory on a variety of grounds. The most honest theorists recognize that it's a problematic theory, but their concern, which is a legitimate concern, is that barriers to trade are equally problematic because they are also enacted in order to serve the rent-seeking interests of particular elites. You know, and that's also true. So it's not the case that the social forces in play in Mexico are such that if you didn't have NAFTA, you'd have egalitarian social justice economic policies. You'd have rent-seeking elite corrupt policies of a different sort. And those weren't beneficial to the Mexican peasants either, you know, the poor people of Mexico. So that's the problem, that there are alternative trade regimes which, if combined with alternative power relations, would be way better for people. It's just not so simple that alternative trade regimes under unaltered power relations would be better. So I don't, the counterfactual, what would things be like in Mexico now if NAFTA hadn't passed, but everything else in the world went the way it did? It's just not so clear. It might be better. You know, this could be even worse. But you can't just assess that question by looking at how much worse things are now for a segment of the population compared to 30 years ago. There's just too many other forces in play here. So, I mean, I'm not pro-NAFTA, I'm not saying. Yeah, you had a...
So this is just stupid. I kind of want to know what you say. So there's like, effective altruism, like Pierce Singer, and there's this idea that, like, you know, what you should do is, like, you should go to school for business and get a really high-paying job and just distribute that wealth yourself, like, through charity. I mean, I think it's stupid because I don't think it'll... You change things, but it's not stupid in the sense that it actually will help individual people. I was wondering what you think about ideas like that. Like, maybe when we're deciding where we should go to school, what we should do, that's what we should do.
Well, it's not... If you don't suffer from weakness of will...
Yeah,
it's a brilliant idea. You know, it's a brilliant idea to get a lot of radicals into business schools and to who will generate huge amounts of capital accumulation, and then for them to live modestly, and then create. And this is a key additional point: create the kind of foundation to distribute these funds that does not itself become a dominating force. So one of the problems, you know, I think it's quite laudable what the Gates Foundation is doing in one sense. That is, an unbelievably rich person like the Gates don't have to have a giant campaign to get rid of malaria. And they have provided, that's I think one of their best initiatives, they've provided huge amounts of resources to things that are actually quite effective, like mosquito nets. So rather than distributing them, and lots of lives have been saved by virtue of that. That's great. But it's still them deciding what's going to be best for other people, and that's a very problematic aspect of it. But the problem is, it's pretty hard for somebody to go to business school and to actually successfully make a large fortune without, in the course of that, having their reference group and their sense of identity being profoundly altered. It's not that it's unthinkable, it's just extremely, you know, hard to do. And,
So the part that's the part of the reason that I asked that question earlier is that I sort of entertained that notion, right? I thought, maybe I'll apply to business school. Maybe I'll, go into business and see if I could do that. But I think, I think what you said about it's so difficult for an individual to do that because I would just feel so awful about myself, because the culture that surrounds it is so infectious, and I feel like even if you were super principled, it would be really, really hard, and all the people around you would be like, "What are you doing?" Because that would be your social network, and so I feel like you would just feel alienated. It would be alienating, and you'd have to be sort of on your own little ideological island. That doesn't sound like a flourishing life,
Yeah.
Also, if you did that, you'd still be making your fortune by exploiting other people and not living your ideals. And I also just have lots of conflicting problems of just giving money to people. There's a lot of white savior complexing that happens and a lot of things like that. So, I don't know.
Right, so the issue there is whether there are appropriate vehicles for having private resources being directed towards social justice ends that doesn't have that imperialistic character. And I think that's like anything, there's always dilemmas and trade-offs, but I do think that it's definitely not an excuse for wealthy people not to give because there's no uncontaminated way to do it.
Yeah.
To begin with. Also, I think it's a mistake to completely write off business schools. Matt Early, who's the co-founder of Just Coffee, at one point decided to go to UW Business School because there were things he needed to learn in order for Just Coffee to actually thrive. And he didn't, he was an amateur. He didn't know how to do that. He got involved with coffee because he went down as an activist to Chiapas during the height of the Zapatista movements and worked there for a couple of years and got to be really good friends with people in some coffee grower cooperatives, and they were desperate. They were having great difficulty getting their coffee marketed, and he said he'd come back to Madison, see what he could do. He came back, he didn't have a clue, and apparently the story is that one of the people in the coffee growers cooperative introduced him at a meeting and said that, and just said, and Matt says that he hadn't said anything about this, he said, "Well, Matt's just going to import all this coffee for us." And at that meeting, Matt said, "All right, I'll do that." Came back to Madison and set up this coffee roaster to live up to his, So business school does teach actual skills about how to navigate a market economy in the world in which we are. And there are some business schools, actually, which have a progressive component. This may seem kind of weird to you. I'm giving a keynote address at something called the American Management Association, I think, something like that, which is a left-wing business school association that has an annual meeting. Last year's theme was alternatives to capitalism. This year's theme is alternatives to the corporation. They want me to talk about that. And these are business school professors from around the country coming to talk about alternatives, they're in prominent business schools and small business schools, but they're not marginal characters. So there is space in business schools for progressive ideas, and therefore, within the business school world, one can survive. Question is, and in the corporate world, it's tougher, but there are some corporations that have, that have social responsibility offices which are not purely symbolic. That is in the sense that, here's just the way to think about this. If you're a strong enough, powerful enough corporation that your brand actually gives you what are called rents, that is super profits above the competitive equilibrium of a market, that gives you a certain freedom. That gives you freedom to do stuff that are deviant from the point of view of the way corporations behave. And there are some corporations that are really take that quite seriously. And not just as publicity, not just as PR to keep the wolves at bay, but because particular CEOs really care about certain things. It's looked at by more hard-nosed business people as being self-indulgent on their part. You know, this is like a hobby. Social justice is their hobby. So there are niches within the corporate world where one can do some good. This isn't by way of saying, and that's the wave of the future. I think in general, social responsibility offices of corporations are pure symbolic, trying to create corporations with a human face, like the way Walmart does.
If
you go to
business school,
I have a suggestion
on you.
Okay.
You
can
navigate the subject and qualifications, the key principles.
Okay. Well, okay, it's 12. It's time to say goodbye. I hope those of you who I won't in the normal course of things just see in the hallways in the social science building that you from time to time drop in and tell me how things are going. There are students from earlier generations of this class from 20 years ago I'm still in touch with. So, but the burden, I'm afraid, is on you to be in touch with me. Then I can be in touch with you. Thanks so much for such a great semester.
All right.